This Janet Meffer Today podcast is brought to you by Heart for Lebanon. Heart for Lebanon is bringing food, Christian education, and the gospel of Jesus Christ to the thousands of displaced children flooding into Lebanon's refugee camps. Help the Christian response to terrorism today with a gift of $98. 866-485-9187. 866-485-9187 or janetmefford.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Thank you so much for joining us again. The New York Times. I think I could do a show every single day just using New York Times articles as jumping off points for insanity. I really could, although that would be boring after a while, and that really isn't why I'm here. But in this case, I have to turn to this article from the New York Times. This is the headline. Transgender could be defined out of existence under Trump administration. Wow, I didn't realize the Trump administration had so much power that it could take a term and just jettison it from the language. That's not really what they're talking about. Here's what they say. The Trump administration is considering narrowly defining gender as a biological immutable condition determined by genitalia at birth. I didn't even get through the whole sentence. They're outraged that the Trump administration is narrowly defining gender as biological and immutable based on what your genitalia say you are. Oh, do you mean the way that everybody in the history of the world has defined sex, not gender, but sex since time began? That's really outrageous, New York Times. Okay, they call it the most drastic move yet in a government-wide effort to roll back recognition and protections of transgender people under federal civil rights law. They're talking about Title IX, by the way. They say the Department of Health and Human Services is spearheading an effort to establish a legal definition of sex under Title IX, the federal civil rights law that bans gender discrimination in education programs that receive government financial assistance. This is from a memo that the New York Times obtained. The department argued in its memo that key government agencies needed to adopt an explicit and uniform definition of gender as determined on a biological basis that is clear, grounded in science, objective, and administrable. What's wrong with that? Because the Human Rights Campaign doesn't like it. The left doesn't like it. We're in a brave new up for grabs gender ideology, and you will do what the left tells you to do, and you will accept all sorts of new categories that defy objective reality, and you will like it. And if you don't like it, you're going to get yelled at by the New York Times. Well, it isn't just the New York Times that is yelling. There are all sorts of leftists who are out there yelling about it and misrepresenting what the Trump administration is actually talking about. Here's a piece in the Washington Examiner called "No, President Trump Isn't Waging Transgenocide." Lies about the Trump administration continue to proliferate. In the media's latest race to the bottom, they cite the New York Times article and say that his actual offense, meaning President Trump, is DHS is attempting to redefine the legal definition of sex under Title IX as a person's status as male or female based on immutable biological traits identifiable by or before birth. You know, the same definition employed by Presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama until 2010. For one thing, this is a practically immaterial story. Title IX, the federal civil rights law, states no person in the U.S. shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. In practice, Title IX has mainly culminated in two things: ensuring that women's collegiate athletics receive equal funding and representation to that of men's programs, and ensuring that students experiencing gender discrimination, sexual assault, or harassment have a formal form of recourse. So in essence, if the HHS successfully modified the Title IX definition, a female identifying as a male would still be able to try a sexual assault in Title IX proceedings or even participate in male athletics at the discretion of the university. So how is this a freak out? I don't understand. Title IX has absolutely nothing to do with gender identity. So changing the definition of sex changes absolutely nothing. And rather than pointing out that perhaps the Department of Education could consider adding an extra protection specifically for transgender Americans, the media went into a full-scale meltdown. Jonathan Weissman, from the New York Times put on Twitter. The Trump administration has a new definition of sex that would render 1.4 million transgendered people legally non-existent. It's not true. It's ridiculous. Another woman put out on Twitter, this means that a trans woman like that in America would no longer have any legal protection from harassment and hate crimes as a trans person or as a woman. They would overnight be regulated out of being able to exist in public life. That is so not true. It's ridiculous. These people are crazy. They're crazy. That's not what's going on here. You will be legally non-existent as if the person doesn't have any rights as a citizen of the United States, regardless of gender dysphoria. That's simply crazy. And I will call it crazy. But this is what these people are, crazy. And you know why? Because to talk about transgender as if it's some sort of wonderful new category that we have just been too stupid to adopt up until now is itself ridiculous. It's ridiculous. When you're talking about people who suffer from gender dysphoria, what you're talking about is somebody who has a feeling inside that is not in conjunction with reality. It's out of step. It's like an anorexia victim who says, I'm fat, but when you look in the mirror, you weigh 80 pounds. But I feel fat. I feel fat. I'm a fat person. Would you help that person diet? No. You would say the problem is not your body. The problem is in your head or your heart or your soul, and you need treatment and you need somebody who is equipped to help you. That's what needs to happen with people with gender dysphoria. As we talked not too long ago with Laura Perry, wonderful girl, wonderful Christian girl who went through the entire surgery to become a man and was living life as a man. And you heard her testimony on the show, how the Lord changed her from the inside out. And slowly she began the process of reestablishing her given, God-given identity as a woman. She did not have a problem with her body. She had a problem inside her soul. She had a problem inside her heart and her mind, and she needed help, and she got the help that she needed, and then she returned to her God-given sex. So why are we encouraging people who really have problems like this to have a new identity that has a unique protection under federal law? It's all part of this gender ideology. Let me give you a perfect example of this, how this goes awry, how this becomes completely out of control. You heard recently about the UCI Masters Track World Championship cycling contest. Did you hear about this just a few days ago? Well, you had a trans woman, in other words, a man, who's an assistant professor of philosophy at the College of Charleston in South Carolina, winning this competition. And the third place rider, who's a real woman, went out on Twitter and said, I was the third place rider. It's definitely not fair. Now, she's right. It's not fair. We all understand that women and men do not have the same biological capabilities when it comes to athletic activity. Men generally, and there are exceptions, of course, but men generally are taller and stronger and can run faster and can jump higher. It's just a biological reality. We all know this. We all know this is the case. And what happens? There was a backlash, and she took it back. She took it back. She said, after having some time to reflect, I realized my Twitter comments earlier this week unintentionally fanned the flames on a controversial situation, and that I regret. I made the comments out of a feeling of frustration, but they weren't productive or positive. You know what? Don't walk it back. Don't walk it back. One of the things that's become so crazy is the fact that you have feminists, people who once called themselves feminists, who were talking about the reality of women being oppressed and women needed to have equal rights to men and all this, are now themselves seeing men encroaching upon women's activities, and they know they're men and they're upset about it, but they feel constrained by political correctness that they can't say anything about it. And I say enough is enough. Enough is enough. You don't have to accept a man being part of a woman's sports competition when you know he's a man who's just confused about his sex. That's not your fault, and it is unfair. And I wish more feminists, women who really do cop to feminist ideology, people like Camille Paglia, for example, who gets this, come out and say, this is ridiculous. We're not accepting transgenderism as some sort of legitimate category. This is not a legitimate category. We have male and we have female. We've understood this since time immemorial, that there's male and there's female. Yes, a very, very minute portion of the population is born intersex, but even then you identify with the sex that you more closely aligns to what you feel like, and that's something a doctor helps with. But it's not the same thing as transgenderism. So expect more screaming from the left, but the people who really need to get their act together are the people who are screaming about it. We're going to come back. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today.
From Graceworks Pictures comes Indivisible, based on the true story of Army Chaplain Darren Turner and his wife, Heather.
It is with great honor that I have served my country, but I only stand before you today because Jesus is my rock and because I have a family who loves and believes in me.
One marriage, one family, under God. Indivisible, rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13. In theaters October 26th. More information is available at indivisiblemovie.com.
A little Muslim girl named Ava and her family were forced out of their home in Syria and fled to a dirty tent settlement in Lebanon. But that's where they met the Christians at Heart for Lebanon's Hope Center. Now Ava is being fed, getting a Christian education, and watching Jesus transform her life. But Heart for Lebanon needs your help. For $22, you'll be helping four kids just like Ava, giving them help and the hope of the gospel. 866-485-9187. 866-485-9187. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you'll access health care, so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 per month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org. Regain control over your healthcare costs. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. That number again, 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. Welcome back. Well, this is a terrible headline from The Atlantic. Women in the U.S. can now get safe abortions by mail. Oh, it's terrible. As they report, the founder of a global abortion pill provider that has never shipped to the United States has quietly started a new service for American women to have medication-induced abortions at home. This is absolutely terrible. And my next guest says that her pro-life group is exploring the possibility of congressional intervention to stop this. We're going to get some thoughts on it now from Americans United for Life president and CEO Catherine Glenn Foster. So good to have you here, Catherine. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Well, this is an interesting, horrible idea, obviously, and it had been the case that this group called Women on Web never was doing this, according to this piece, in the United States. But then the founder of Women on Web has started this new group, Aid Access, to provide abortion pills to women. What's going on here so people understand?
Yeah, so her name is Rebecca Gompert. She's the founder of Women on Waves and Women on Web. Basically made her name in trying to get abortions for women in countries that have substantial restrictions, health and safety regulations, things like that, where there wasn't a lot of abortion going on. And so she would pull up a boat and take women into international waters and perform abortions on this boat. Mm. Then Women on Web is shipping these abortion drugs around the world, is just sending them off to women. No real no on-site medical care, no real hope there that they could, that they necessarily have a close by hospital or other emergency medical facility. It's almost like, when they say, the back alley, they're always talking about the back alley of abortion. Well, you're making women's homes, women's workplaces, the new back alley. Right. And it's a dangerous idea.
Well, it is. It's kind of interesting because according to the story, Gompertz launched this service about 6 months ago, but kept it under the radar because she evidently didn't want pro-lifers to know much about it. But why was it that women on web didn't ship to the U.S., but now she had to form this new group in order to get the drugs to American women?
Yeah, it's interesting, actually. So according to this article and according to the interview with Gompertz, she said that she was concerned about the pro-life movement. You know, that we are making such progress, that we are, changing hearts and minds to the point where she said, you know, that we would try to shut down the organization. And so she said, you know, she has decided to go ahead and do it, but she does know, and I think that's clear from her actions and from the lack of transparency here, that we are going to push back. You know, we know that this is a reckless plan. It's an irresponsible plan.
Right.
That it's a plan that could well, sadly, injure even kill women. And it's nothing that we would ever recommend for the sake of the women, as well as, of course, for the sake of the children.
Right. Well, talk a little bit, if you would, Catherine, about the risks to women. If they receive these abortion medications in the mail, obviously you don't have a doctor there presiding over your results. And I know that Dr. Gompertz says, well, she'll be available via Skype. I mean, would we do this in any other circumstance where you might be bleeding? This is insane. But what are the real risks to women? Because they're trying to tout this as perfectly safe.
Exactly. I sure hope that we would not consider this with any medical procedure, with any invasive procedure or drug where you're doing something like this to your body. So there are a number of different risks. First, and I think most critically, studies have shown that chemical abortions by drugs, carry an even greater risk of major complications like hemorrhage, like massive bleeding, like sepsis, you know, life-threatening infection, even than surgical abortions do. It can be dangerous. It can be life-threatening.
Right.
And then on top of that, you're not looking at a procedure in a medical facility where they're performing an ultrasound. So with no ultrasound being performed in conjunction with this abortion, it is impossible to know, for the doctor to know, for the staff to know, whether the pregnancy could be ectopic, mm-hmm. which is dangerous, is potentially life-threatening, and it's a condition that no abortion clinic would try to manage. Even if you have a normal uterine pregnancy, the abortion pill, the abortion drug, it doesn't always work. There's a percentage of women ranging from about 5% to over 20%, depending on the gestational age, for whom it does not work, and that's very concerning. And then of course there's that percentage of women who should not have surgical abortions because they do have an elevated risk, and yet the protocol for a failed chemical abortion is to move towards surgical abortion. And meanwhile, the proponents of this kind of just reckless, dangerous plan are saying that if women are taking the abortion drugs and it doesn't work, or they start having heavy bleeding, or there's some other complication, like at least 3% of women have, then they're generally advised to just go to a hospital and say that they had a miscarriage.
Mm.
And essentially, they're being advised to lie to hospitals, to their new healthcare team, about what put them there.
Good grief. How is that? How is that allowed for this company to be advising women to lie to healthcare providers? Can't they be nailed on that alone?
Yeah, I mean, it is so reckless. It is so irresponsible for a healthcare team not to know just, you know, what drugs are floating around in your body. You know, there's a reason why they ask you those questions on intake. You know, what could be going on with you? They need to know that information to be able to appropriately triage and treat you. And so that, too, may be one of the factors that that Rebecca Gompertz was so concerned about, because we do have those, you know, very protective laws in the U.S. in at least some circumstances where we recognize, you know, we're not supposed to be lying to our healthcare providers. It's not a good idea. And if we have a company trying to urge women to do that, and thereby women are getting incomplete care, perhaps even the wrong care, because providers don't know what's going on with them, with their systems, that could lead to serious complications as well.
Right. Is there anything that could be done on a congressional level, Catherine, to stop this from occurring? I know telemed abortions are available in various places in the United States, and perhaps they're trying to say we're the same thing. But is there something that could be done legislatively to shut this down?
Right. So, you know, telemed abortions, they have been introduced certain places, and telemedicine can be a wonderful thing when it's used properly. There are some conditions, some venues, some areas where it has real promise. When it comes to abortion, it is dangerous. It is irresponsible. And what we're talking about is remote medical care for such an invasive procedure. This is something that we are at AUL, at Americans United for Life, we are very concerned about this. So we have a team of attorneys researching the matter. We are discussing it already with potential supporters on the Hill. We are working to make sure that the women of America stay safe.
Well, that's excellent. I would support that wholeheartedly, because you certainly don't want to play with people's lives like this. And it's not just the life of the baby, but the lives of the mothers. Is this also, Catherine, part and parcel of the fact that abortion clinics keep closing down, that it's more and more difficult to find a surgical abortionist, and that's why you see more and more of these medication-induced abortions on the rise?
You know, I think it may be a bit of a chicken and egg. You know, we see that there's been this push for these abortion drugs, these chemical abortions, and so certainly we've seen at least in some areas the demand for supply and demand language, that the demand for surgical abortions going down. And we may think, well, that's a good thing, but we need to also make sure that we are appropriately tracking what's going on here with these chemical abortions, that we have responsible reporting and we're able to track the complications. So often we're not able to track, especially when women are being told to go and lie to their healthcare professionals, to their to a hospital team or other emergency care teams. We don't have full and complete data. All we know is that there have been very serious complications. And so we do see, the surgical abortion centers shutting down in a lot of cases. Sometimes it's a business decision. They decide to consolidate. Sometimes it's a business decision with supply and demand. But we have seen the numbers drop precipitously even since the mid-1990s, just over the last 20 or so years. We've seen a dramatic drop.
All right. Well, that is really important information, Catherine, and I'm so glad that you guys are on this, because as you said earlier, it is important to explore the possibility of congressional intervention so women in the United States cannot get any abortions by mail. It's simply outrageous. You can check out Americans United for Life at AUL.org. Thank you so much, Catherine, for being here. And from Graceworks Pictures comes Indivisible, based on the true story of Army Chaplain Darren Turner and his wife, Heather. Indivisible, rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13 in theaters October 26th. More information is available at indivisiblemovie.com. We'll be right back. This Janet Meffer Today podcast is brought to you by Heart for Lebanon. Heart for Lebanon is bringing food, Christian education, and the gospel of Jesus Christ to the thousands of displaced children flooding into Lebanon's refugee camps. Help the Christian response to terrorism today with a gift of $98. 866-485-9187. 866-485-9187 or janetmefford.com. Back on Janet Meffer Today. While the great preachers and theologians of Christian history are regularly given their due for their contributions to the church and to the advancement of the gospel of Jesus Christ, but as they say, behind every great man is a great woman, and that was true of Susanna Spurgeon. Her husband was the Prince of Preachers, Charles Haddon Spurgeon. What role did his wife play in his life and in his ministry that helped him to achieve so much for the Lord? Really a fascinating topic and the subject of a new book by my next guest, Ray Rhodes Jr. He serves as founding pastor of Grace Community Church of Dawsonville, Georgia, and as president of Nourished in the Word Ministries. His book is called Susie, The Life and Legacy of Susanna Spurgeon, Wife of Charles H. Spurgeon. And so good to have you here, Pastor Rhodes. Welcome.
Great to be with you, Janet. I've looked forward to this.
I have too. I love Charles Spurgeon, and I always love hearing about the wives because you never get as much press for the wives. But I understand you actually wrote your thesis on their marriage, didn't you?
I did. I did my doctoral thesis on spirituality in their marriage, primarily Bible reading and prayer.
That is so neat. Now, why do you think it's important to know a little bit about Susanna? What is special about her? What is significant about her, would you say?
Yeah, many things. But, of course, being married to the most popular preacher of the Victorian era and arguably in the top 10, maybe the top 5 of most popular, well-known preachers in all of Christian history, Charles Spurgeon. So that in itself should pique our interest a bit to who was this guy married to?
Right. Exactly. Because it does make a difference. What about her background? Can you tell us a little bit about Susie and how she grew up, what her family was like before she married Charles?
Yeah, Janet. She grew up in England, in London. She was in London and spent a good bit of time in Paris as well in her later teenage years. So she was a lady of the city. Her father is R.B. Thompson, and her mother's name also was Susanna, which makes for some interesting reading in the book. We have three Susannas in one chapter interacting with one another.
Wow.
But no one had ever mentioned her mother's name in any literature, and I was able to find that as I looked through census reports and whatnot. But her dad was up and down financially. He was in sales mostly and traveling a good bit with that. He was centered for most of his business career in central London, and so Susie spent a good bit of time there as well. But her mother died at age 57 after Susie was married, so she had pretty much an upper middle class upbringing, though at times her dad's finances sunk pretty low. But she was surrounded by extended family members who were people of means, and I think that they also came to her support and perhaps answers the question how she got to Paris so many times.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. Did she come from a Christian home? Did she have a lot of Christians in her family?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Her grandparents seem to have been relatively active in the Church of England. Her dad was baptized as a baby in an independent church that can be connected back to George Whitfield, in fact, mm-hmm. Much earlier, of course. So he came from an independent perspective. Her mother came from a Church of England perspective. And in Victorian England, Bible reading and prayer, usually twice a day, was a part of many English homes. Now, that doesn't mean, of course, that the scripture was loved and valued and Christ was treasured so much as it was just a part of the culture.
Right.
Maybe as we think of early American culture, Bible reading and prayer was just a part of the culture. And that's the way it was during Victorian time. So she grew up reading the Bible, hearing the Bible, and at least at some point she was attending church regularly at the very church that Charles Spurgeon would come and preach at. She was not a member, but she was attending, had been attending for some time.
Interesting. Now, I know you mentioned some of her spiritual struggles. What did those involve?
Yes, she was not a believer, not a convinced Christian at least. even though she attended church. And she would see, this was a Baptist congregation now, so her parents are going to a Baptist congregation, the New Park Street Chapel, closer to the time that she will eventually meet Spurgeon. And so she is seeing baptismal candidates being baptized, and she wonders if she will ever be able to be baptized. She doesn't have the assurance that her heart has been changed, that Christ is her Savior. And so she struggles in that regard. And then probably in late 1852, she attends a service, not at the New Park Street Chapel, but a place called the Poultry Chapel, not far from where she lived. And heard a preacher preaching from Romans chapter 10, and she dates that as the awakening of her soul and her true conversion. However, she doesn't tell anyone. She keeps that a private matter, and she almost immediately begins struggling spiritually. And so she sees herself, to use an older word, she sees herself as backslidden and cold, really, to the things of God. And that would continue into 1854, when she becomes increasingly connected to Charles Spurgeon.
Well, that's so interesting. So as a new Christian, she thought she was backslidden? Is that, or was there something else that occurred after her conversion that gave her some doubt?
No, she doesn't. There doesn't seem to be any sort of scandalous behavior or any pronounced sin or anything like that. It's just that she keeps it bottled up inside her new profession of faith, and rather than tell anyone, which wouldn't have been that uncommon perhaps in Victorian culture, when young ladies would have been maybe silent about what they consider to be more private matters.
Right.
And the Christian faith for a young lady might have been something like that. So she didn't tell anyone. She just says that her heart grew colder and she lacked assurance of salvation. And she just, backsliding, but not really pointing to any specific and pronounced sin. But she's just struggling internally with the reality of her salvation. And she sees that in her attitude towards Charles the first time she hears him preach.
Wow. What was that like? Because they met and she was still in that state then when she met him.
That's right. Charles was pastoring. You know, he became a pastor at 17 up in north of London in a place called Waterbeach at the Waterbeach Chapel, Baptist Chapel there. It was just a village congregation, maybe about 40 people when he arrived at age 17. And by the time he's 19 years old, there's 400 people there and many conversions and just a great work of God in this little village. Well, word gets to London that there's this young phenomenon there in Waterbeach, and the New Park Street Chapel is without a pastor. They invite Charles Spurgeon to come down to London and fill the pulpit as a guest preacher and just to see what this young man is about. He comes on December the 18th, 1856. When he gets the invitation, he thinks they must be mistaken. You must have some other Charles Spurgeon in mind. You certainly couldn't be talking about me, a country boy in a country village congregation. But indeed, they were. And so he made the journey down to London. And Susie was not in attendance that morning, but she did come with some friends that evening, Thomas Olney and family, who were just stalwart members of the church, and also was her family, was kin to her by marriage. So they convinced her to come in the evening service, and she saw Charles Spurgeon for the first time in that distinguished pulpit, remembering the previous pastors who were certainly distinguished city, more men of the city. And he didn't fit. In fact, she was offended by the way he looked, his clothing, his hair, his handkerchief that he waved, the way he spoke.
pretty much everything.
She pretty much covered all the bases. Nothing was impressive to her about this young man. Why in the world, even though the church had declined greatly, she still couldn't understand why such a church with such a history, John Gill, Benjamin Keach, some of the great names in Baptist history had pastored there in its other forms. She couldn't understand why they would invite this country boy, brilliant as he was, nevertheless, but why would they invite him to preach? And so that was her, whether they met that night, she couldn't remember, nor could he, but they would get acquainted a bit later.
Yeah, and it seems like going back to what you said earlier, she really was a girl of the city, so she would have had that concern more than maybe a country girl would have had.
That's right. Yeah, she. All the evidence says that she was very refined, very cultured. She would have, of course, known art and music, and she had made multiple trips to Paris. She had learned to speak French fluently.
Wow.
Charles couldn't speak French. And yeah, hang she on. Had toured the.
Yeah, hang on just a moment. We do need to take a quick break, and we'll come back to Pastor Ray Rhodes Jr. His book is called Susie, The Life and Legacy of Susanna Spurgeon. We'll be right back.
From Graceworks Pictures comes Indivisible, based on the true story of Army Chaplain Darren Turner and his wife, Heather.
It is with great honor that I have served my country, but I only stand before you today because Jesus is my rock and because I have a family who loves and believes in me.
One marriage, one family, under God. Indivisible, rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13. In theaters October 26th. More information is available at indivisiblemovie.com.
A little Muslim girl named Ava and her family were forced out of their home in Syria and fled to a dirty tent settlement in Lebanon. But that's where they met the Christians at Heart for Lebanon's Hope Center. Now Ava is being fed, getting a Christian education, and watching Jesus transform her life. But Heart for Lebanon needs your help. For $22, you'll be helping four kids just like Ava, giving them help and the hope of the gospel. 866-485-9187. 866-485-9187. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you'll access health care, so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 per month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org. Regain control over your healthcare costs. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. That number again, 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. I'm Janet Mefford today. Great to have you with us, and great to have with us Pastor Ray Rhodes Jr. His book is called Susie, The Life and Legacy of Susanna Spurgeon, the wife of Charles Haddon Spurgeon. And I just love these sorts of books where you can learn a little bit more about the woman behind the man. And I, you know, it makes me smile a little bit, Pastor Rhodes, when you talk about how Susie regarded Charles when she first saw him in the pulpit. Here he was, this country boy. She didn't like the way he looked or the way he dressed, and she was kind of refined. And it's kind of like the plot of a romantic comedy. You know these two are going to end up together at some point when there's this reaction initially from Susie. But how was it that they finally did get together and finally did get married, fall in love, and form a family together?
Right. And things really began happening pretty quickly, which is also adds to the comedy of this. So if you remember back to the December night when she's unimpressed with him. But she is still struggling spiritually. And her cousin by marriage, William only, who married her cousin, Susanna.
Wow.
By the way. Yeah, another Susanna, very famous name, popular name in that day. He told Charles about her spiritual struggles. And from that, Charles then, as just showing pastoral concern, sent her a copy of The Pilgrim's Progress and inscribed it in something to the effect of, with prayers for your progress in the faith. Well, she was moved by that, and she certainly would have been familiar with Pilgrim's Progress, Bunyan buried there in London as well, and probably had read it, but now it took on new significance because though Spurgeon was not formally the pastor when he sent her the book, he would be like a week or two later. So he was almost officially the pastor of the church at that time. He'd been preaching back and forth since January. And so that led to, and by the way, Charles is in this Olney home a lot as well with and seeing Susanna there. So she begins to open up to him about her spiritual struggles. And he becomes something of a counselor to her. And she begins trusting him, appreciating him. And later she'll write how that first meeting, it was due to, not really due to him at all, it was due to her own heart that was cold and struggling in the things of God. She didn't recognize the beauty of the gospel that was preached that December evening. Well, that led to them getting to know one another better, but Susie had no real thought of romance, nor is there any indication that Charles did, but obviously he did, because in June, at the grand reopening of the Crystal Palace, which was something like the World's Fair of that day, housed there in London, beautiful, huge facility, they were having the celebration, the Grand March, and a group from the New Park Street Chapel was seated together. Charles and Susie happened to be seated side by side. And Charles hands her a copy of Martin Tupper's Proverbial Philosophy, and there's a section in that on marriage. And he points to a verse that mentions praying for the one who is to be your spouse.
Oh, wow.
And he asks her, he says, Susie, do you pray for the one who is to be your spouse? And she knew what he was talking about. Her eyes were open. She had a romantic awakening, if you will. His message was crystal clear to her in that day and time. And then he whispered again after a bit. He said, would you mind taking a walk with me? And so they walked around the palace. They walked outside. They walked down by the lake together. There was these models, these creature models of extinct, what we now know as dinosaurs, some of the very first dinosaur models there at the Crystal Palace. And she writes about those. And by the way, those are still there today. You can go see the ruins of the palace. You can see those dinosaur models where love blossomed. And she says that love was awakened that night and everything seemed different from that moment on. And just a couple months later in August, they're engaged. So from December of 1853 to August of 1854, not even a year's passed, and Charles Spurgeon, Susanna Thompson are engaged to be married.
Wow. Well, he baptized her too, didn't he?
He did. He did baptize her prior to their marriage in 1855. And in that day, it was a lot more than simply walking down the aisle and shaking the preacher's hand and being baptized soon after. There was quite an extensive process where you applied for membership, you were examined in your home by elders from the church, you submitted a written testimony, you met with the pastor of the church, you met before the congregation of the church and gave your testimony, and all of that happened prior to baptism. So even with his fiance, Spurgeon took his time and helped to, which really helped her as well to see her true faith and the fruit of that. And he was astonished, which tells me that Susie did have a strong foundation growing up, at least an understanding of the Scripture, a knowledge of the Scripture, because within a very brief time after her conversion and after her sort of jolt spiritually with Charles's counsel, she is growing very quickly, and Spurgeon really is stunned by the depth of her testimony in 1855 and when he baptizes her.
Yeah. Wow. Well, and people will need to read the book to get the full story, which is fascinating. But what would you say was her greatest impact on his ministry, which, of course, extended over many more years during their marriage, and a lot went on, the downgrade controversy and all the rest. But as you look at the totality of the marriage, what would you say Susanna's greatest contribution to her husband really was?
While they're both together, whilst Charles is still alive, Susie early on, really towards the end of their engagement or near the end of their engagement, she embraced with a wholehearted commitment what being Mrs. Spurgeon meant, and committed, though she had struggled, and her mother had to help her. Thankfully, she had a wise mother who didn't put a wedge between Charles and Susie at all, but brought them to even closer together, that she committed to embracing his ministry, to supporting him wholeheartedly, to never hindering him from doing what she believed God had called him to do. And I think that foundational commitment pretty early in their relationship, before they were married, really set him free to be the Charles Spurgeon that we love today and remember, to do the work that he did. And it also, it set her free to not live with some unrealistic expectation that he's the sort of guy that's going to be home every day of the year and and be as involved, perhaps, and as we might think in our day and time of what a husband and wife should be. But when I say that, I want to be very careful to say that these two loved each other dearly, and they took care of one another. So though being married to Spurgeon was a very unique situation, even among those who are busy pastors, he was as busy as one could even imagine being.
Oh, yes.
He took care of his wife. He loved her dearly. And their love letters are just, I've often thought they would make a Victorian blush the way they wrote so freely to one another.
Oh, man. Well, that's so neat. And, you know, you talk also about the fact that she had a ministerial impact of her own, didn't she, in her own right. And she had the book fund. And she was a really amazing woman in a lot of ways.
She was. Just being married to him was challenging enough, and she was often lonely because he's preaching sometimes 10 times a week in various places. But also, early in their marriage, the first 10 or so years, she travels with him on some of the long journeys. And one of the things that was so surprising about Susie to me was that she was a mountain hiker.
Wow.
So, yeah, that I never thought that. I often thought of Mrs. Spurgeon. I automatically go to her sickness and her affliction and all that. But prior to that, she hiked most of the major Swiss Alps, most of the Alps passages, and traveled widely with Spurgeon. She was in Calvin's church when Spurgeon preached there and was so proud of him and Calvin's pulpit. Hmm. Both of them were strong Calvinists. She embraced Spurgeon's theology early on, which and maybe she had embraced that even as from a child. It's just not clear on that. But in 1868, she was afflicted. The specifics we don't know. We do know some sort of female issue. She had surgery by the most famed gynecologist of the day, who was a believer and friends with Charles. But she was pretty much homebound from 1868 onward. However, in 1875, Charles' first volume of Lectures to My Students was about to be released, and he handed her a proof copy and asked her what she thought of it. She read it, and she was just overtaken with appreciation and said, I wish we could give a copy of this book to every pastor in England. And Charles said, well, Susie, why don't you make that happen? He was always encouraging her to serve the Lord faithfully on her own.
I love it.
He would be her support. He honored her. And, you know, Janet, thinking about Victorian times and the women in Victorian times, many women probably felt that they were under the thumb of their husbands, and they were. They had few or no rights. But not Susanna Spurgeon.
Well, I'll tell you what, people need to read your book. We're running out of time here, but the name of the book is Susie, The Life and Legacy of Susanna Spurgeon by Ray Rhodes Jr., who's been so kind to be with us. Great book, and so good to talk to you, Pastor Rhodes. Thank you very, very much.
Oh, well, thank you, Janet. I enjoyed being on your show.
Well, enjoyed having you. God bless you, and thanks for being with us on Janet Meffer Today.